Good morning. I'll call to order meeting the Conference Committee for State Government Budget Bill for May 9, 2009. The Senate does not have a quorum, the House does, but we need to get started here. Let me just explain, the Senate actually went until midnight, just close to midnight last night. The House went until, I guess, about 11:10. We did move back the time here this morning to get for one of the members' considerations. We're not planning on going all day. We're going to get what we're getting done probably this morning, and then that'll be it. But my Senate conferees, Senator Rest and Senator Kubley, had been up quite late the previous night, and Senator Jungbauer, you know, has quite a bit of a drive coming in this morning. And then he's got another commitment too, and then Senator Alfine also has a long drive that he commutes back and forth too. So they are going to be on their way, they promised me, but as I say, they just couldn't promise to be here by 8:30. But Senator Jungbauer, thank you for making it here this morning. Let me just explain a couple of things that in the past couple of days we've been held up on a couple of issues. I can report, first of all, that the Senate has passed Senator Cohen's bill. In fact, maybe we can pass that out now. On the budget process, which the House has some language on. Now the Senate has passed the companion bill, and so we can probably be in a position to discuss that. It just pass it on out, and we won't discuss it right now, but we'll discuss it as we get to those issues. Thank you. And then so that's another issue that the Senate now has a position on. I can also report that yesterday in the Senate Finance Committee we took up the second economic development omnibus bill, and I noted that in the second omnibus, economic development omnibus bill, there was the provision on the co-location of councils of color, and I pointed out that that is strictly within this conference committee's jurisdiction, and in fact the House has a position on that, and I didn't think it was proper to have it in both bills. So I made the motion to remove it from that bill so that it could be in this conference committee. Senator Tomasoni, who's carrying the bill, then had to ask the permission of Representative Rukavina, who happened to be in the room, if that was okay. Representative Rukavina said it was okay for us, for the Senate Finance Committee, to remove that provision, so we did. I did express my gratitude to Representative Rukavina for allowing the Senate Finance Committee to take that position out of the bill. So anyway, so that issue was not in the economic development bill anymore. It is only in this conference committee, and it's something I think we can work on and deal with. But it properly belongs here. The Representative Kahn and I have had some discussions in the last day or so. As you know, we have some Senate positions that are not in the bill, but we have Senate positions. There are House counterparts, and we think that we can probably get those resolved in fairly short order. There's differences, but we'll try to work those through. And then there's a number of House-only positions that we'll just have to go through and figure out what should be in the bill and what should not be. We won't need to discuss that right now. We do want to talk about the budget this morning. The one issue that's been holding us up the last few days is what to do with the tax compliance money. First of all, the number's been kind of changing a bit. And then as those of you who have been following the second tax bill, they actually had some of the tax compliance money in that bill. So it was kind of split between that bill and this bill. So what I would like to do, first of all, is just to clarify, if somebody here is here from either finance or revenue, Minnesota Management and Budget or revenue, and can just tell us what the actual numbers are we can book, that would be helpful just before the Senate actually proposes its offer. So is anybody here that can just, oh, I see, the Deputy Commissioner is here. So, good morning, Deputy Commissioner. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Stephanie Andrews from the Department of Finance. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if you wanted me to talk about, it sounded like your question was about compliance.
Well, two issues, right. First of all, there's some savings that we think that we had some talks with the Commissioner yesterday about possible funding options that we may have for maps and so forth, and some savings that we can garner, He explained a little bit to me, and we asked it to be presented to us. And also, somebody should just tell us what the final number is on tax compliance, whether that's you or somebody from revenue, just so that we know which number we're actually booking here, so we understand we're on the right page here. So whatever information you can provide to us would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Let me talk then about the MEPS and the integrated tax financing. The compliance issues, I'm not sure if revenue can talk to, or we need to get somebody who's been involved in the overall target discussions. I think that may be in that area rather than for the revenue department to talk about. In terms of the integrated tax and MAP proposals, we have, as you know, been part of the conversation with you also about how to look at financing those proposals and whether or not there were ways that we could bring down the costs in the current biennium, reflecting the budget issues that you're facing and that the state government target is facing. And although it's a little bit outside of our comfort zone to move further on some of the lease purchase arrangement, we think that we have a plan here that is still very defensible and also allows you to decrease the costs that you have to put forward in 10-11. So for both integrated tax and MAPS, we looked at revising the financing structure so that rather than doing the level debt and principal that we had in the original proposal, we've moved to something that's fairly standard in other parts of in the private sector. And other public some other public sector projects, where you basically minimize the principal that you're paying in the current biennium until the project is up and running. Many organizations, ourselves included, are faced with running two systems at once, and so you minimize the principal payments that you're paying in until the system is up and running, and then for us in this sense would start paying on the principal and interest in 12 and 13. And so that basically ends up decreasing the cost of both projects significantly. For MAPS, that dropped you from under the $8.9 million that the House had in its original bill, under the governor's original recommendation of $18 million, dropped you down to $7.09 million in fiscal 10-11. Using the same structure for the integrated tax system, you go from a $4.23 million proposal originally to $1.71 million in fiscal 10 and 11. And we can get to those numbers, obviously, by fiscal year. We've talked with revenue about this, too, and they're all right with this. Clearly, this doesn't change, again, how we actually implement the project. This is only a change to the financing piece of it.
So, and if I understand it correctly, what we'd be doing is basically paying some of the interest up front before we start paying for the rest of it, and that's kind of how it's structured. Is that the way it works?
Mr. Chair, we were always paying for some of the interest up front. This basically delays payment of principal until you have the projects up and running in fiscal 12.
Okay. Got it.
I'd like to just say, too, that on the MAPS project, we have another portion that we're changing, too. We're also decreasing our expectations about the overall project cost. As we talked about here in the conference committee earlier, we do believe that in the current environment, we probably can negotiate an even better deal than we'd anticipated with our vendors. And so we're putting a little pressure on ourselves from this financing proposal, but hope to be able to still come through with an even better deal for the state.
Representative Kahn, is there a question?
Yes. The question was, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Ambrose, aren't many private projects funded that way, where the principal is not paid until the project is really delivered?
Commissioner Andrews.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, as we looked at this with our financing people, we felt that this is a very reasonable and it's not outside the norm.
Oh.
Any other questions of the commissioner? Okay, and then, as I say, is somebody from revenue here who can talk about the tax compliance numbers? I don't know if anybody is able to get here, so. Uh-huh. Sure. Welcome to the conference committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Greg Cheatham of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Unfortunately, I'm usually the integrated tax expert, more so than the financial expert. I do know that, and I don't have the exact numbers with me, Dan Salamone and Dan Ostick, our CFO, have sent them both emails and voicemail messages.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the total amounts are still the same. It's just split between the two bills right now.
Well, the last time we had discussed it in this conference committee, the commissioner was here, and he was talking about a total net revenue of $30 million. And since then, obviously with the passage of the tax bill yesterday, it's our understanding that the new number is a net of $45 million.
Correct.
And so that's the number that we're working off. And I just want to double-check that, because that's obviously affecting the numbers that we're working off of now.
That is correct.
Okay, so that was changed.
Right. And actually, I believe the last time in the House is proposed, it was at the $16 million.
Okay.
So that is correct.
But I just want to make sure for our purposes that was the correct number. So that's really what I wanted to clarify. Okay. Okay, is there any questions of either department here before we move on here? Okay. Perhaps then we can have the Senate budget proposal distributed. And as we do, by the way, I do want to congratulate the Republican House or Republican Senate researcher who just became a father the other day, Cinco de Mayo. So he seems a little tired. we're all operating on less sleep these days, but he probably more so. So congratulations. Okay, and as it's distributed, well, let's just wait a minute until everybody's got the sheet in front of them, so then I'll have Mr. Lundeen kind of go through. A lot of it's going to look familiar from what the Senate's proposal was, or the Senate's, what we passed earlier, and we're trying to tighten down those numbers based upon the new tax compliance issues, the new the revision, the targets that we've had as a result of it, so. Let's just wait until everybody gets there. Oh, Representative Holberg.
Do we have the House numbers that are out there available?
Well,
we
could.
Okay, very much.
They're not. Mr. Chairman, we thought, I think the plan was to look at the Senate offer and to hear from Finance's response to the Senate offer, and then we'll put out the House. Then we'll put out the House offer.
Okay.
Well, we may want to recess for about 10 minutes for all the House members to look at it, and then we'll put out a House offer.
I was talking about the original offer.
The first one, right?
Oh.
I don't know if this spreadsheet reflects that, but... Okay. Okay, has everybody got their sheets in the
yes.
room there? Okay, then Mr. Lundeen, could you kind of go through and explain to us the Senate offer here?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Taking a look at the legislature, what the Senate offer contains is a 3% base reduction to the Senate House and LCC.
And which line is it now? They're stapled wrong, so you may have to take them out. This is on line 3, right? Okay, so,
yep.
So they're backwards here. So
yep.
Just tear out the staple, flip the page around, and then you'll have them correctly. Okay, go ahead.
And then also in the legislature on line 8 is the funding for the Minnesota-Manitoba Forum at $10,000 that was in the House bill. Moving down to line 12.
Oh, and we did not fund the redistricting commission either, sir.
No, we did not.
Okay.
On line 12, the Secretary of State, there were no changes. Moving down to line 17, the state auditor, the only change there is we took the House level of funding for the stimulus oversight. Moving down to line 21, the Attorney General, this just retains the original Senate position of the 5% cut to the office budget. Moving down to the Governor's Office, there are a few changes here. We took the operating budget cut, but we kind of came at it a little differently. It's a 3% cut, but we took and added the base and the interagency agreement money that we're putting in there for the policy staff and DC office. So adding that together with the base then comes to $133,000 cut each year of the biennium.
But let me just comment here. Given the fact that the House looked at its budget proposal as being 3%, and the Senate, and frankly, my thought was, you know, the LCC probably, because they serve both bodies of the legislature, needs to be probably around 3% as well, too. The Senate actually took a 3% cut a year ago, and we participated in the allotment. And so we thought we'd adjust our numbers accordingly to around the 3% reduction as the House and the LCC as we proposed. But as long as we were doing that, we thought it was inappropriate for us to basically have a 3% cut for the legislative branch and then require a deeper cut in the governor's office.
So we are proposing the 3% cut for the governor's office, as long as the legislative branch is going to be around the 3% as well, too. Ms. Lundy.
Okay. Moving down to line 30 for the Department of Administration, the in lieu of rent increase is funded at the governor's rec of $500 a year. Funding is also put in for the real property system at the governor's rec of $844 a year. Moving down next would be the Office of Grants Management, and the proposal here is to put in general fund dollars, a direct appropriation, and not have any offsetting from the grants or anything. This would be just straight general fund. The Senate retains the cut to the Self-Advocacy Network grant. The base cut that eliminated the funding for the Enterprise Performance Improvement, this is the LEAN program, that's restored. And then we did not include any funding for the House position for the report on innovation and collaboration. And then we maintained the 5% cut as the governor recommended in our original bill. Moving down to line 41, the Department of Finance, MMB, we retained the 5% cut. We did restore the funding, the general fund for the MAD program, so that restores the base cut.
Although there's a side issue here which we probably need to talk about. As you know, part of the they're trying to move the management analysis development out of admin over into finance or Minnesota management and budget. I'm not sure from a policy standpoint if that's the best thing. So we thought that we might want to think about having that contingent on it staying within admin. I think they do. I think that the people who use this, you know, probably are more used to using it admin. We can talk about that, but we'd like to have some discussion about whether we should complete the move over, you know, out of admin for management announcement budget. So that was there's sort of a little asterisk there for a side discussion. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, the next item on line 43 is the stimulus reporting and oversight, and we have the House position of the one-time funding of $500,000 for that. The next item moving down that we put money into was line 45, the financial oversight and assistance. This was the auditors, and we put in the same amount of funding as the House did, the $512,000 a year. Then moving down to line 48, the Office of Enterprise Technology, the IT security cut that the Senate had in its original bill, we've kind of changed that a bit, and in the second year, instead of totally eliminating the funding, we've restored half of the funding, and I guess there weren't any other changes in OET. Moving down to Campaign Finance Board, we're still including the $50,000 a year for the operating budget, and depending on how we're looking at our tails, we're probably looking at not eliminating the campaign public subsidy in the tails in 10 and 11 and maybe just kind of retaining that as a statutory appropriation, but I think as we deal with the tails, we have to maybe give that another look. There would be no change in administrative hearings. It would be basically the Senate position of moving the $130,000 over there in the first year. Moving down to the Department of Revenue, the only change there, we're not reflecting any of the changes, I think, either with MAPS or with the integrated tax, some of the discussion that we had this morning. But we do have the tax compliance showing there, so you see the 10.3 appropriation that brings in the revenue farther down. No change in the CAP board. Under the Indian Affairs Council, we have included money for the House position for the Indian burial sites. And then to the other councils and the Amateur Sports Commission, no change there. And then moving down to the campaign financing subsidy, I think I did go over that. And then the MAPS replacement. In this proposal, we just have the funding in, and this is on line 87, just the funding in on the second year. But as I said, this didn't reflect some of the information that Ms. Andrews presented to us this morning. And the same with the revenue. We just have the original governor's proposal in there. And then kind of moving down the sheet down to the revenue changes on line 105. I think the big change there is is just booking the additional tax compliance revenue on line 110. And then moving to page 3, and I think we talked the other day about the land sales was done in the environment bill, so we didn't have to concern ourselves with that. And then looking at the facility repair and replacement account in the Department of Administration, this offer is proposing just to take a one-time transfer out of there of just slightly less than $2 million, and then we're retaining the account as it is in present statute and not having any ongoing transfers out of that account to the general fund. And then we retain the TIF transfer from the state auditor, and that's basically the proposal.
We could have obviously done more if we would have had all the tax compliance money, but this is the best we could do with what we had. Any questions or any comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if we could, we'd like about a 10-minute
sure.
recess for the House members to look over the
Absolutely.
House proposal.
Okay. Well, we'll take whatever time you need. And obviously, we are interested in members, you know, not only the House, but if other people spot any particular glaring things that we need to brought to our attention,
yes.
we'll give that opportunity as well, too. So we'll recess to the call of the chair. Thank you. Okay, we are back on the record for the conference committee. The Senate does now have a quorum with the addition of both Senator Olsen and Senator West. I've also had passed just an updated list here of the Senate bills, the current status. There's been a few minor changes on here, but you can at least see where they are within the Senate pipeline. Some are passed, some are on the floor, but at least you've got a better idea where we're at. Representative Kahn, did you have something you wanted to pass, provide?
Yes, we're now passing out the House budget position, which has been just getting closer to the Senate one, which has been, and we've just we incorporated the Senate 3% into it. That was a change that we hadn't. 3% cut
mm-hmm.
that we hadn't made before. That was a little delay, and I'll ask Ms. Roberts to go through the House offer.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the chief of report shows
could you use your mic?
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. The House offer that was made some time earlier
mm-hmm.
last week, and then the House offer for May 9th, and then the difference column shows the difference between those two. If we have time, we can probably put the Senate numbers in also if you want that full comparison. But as Representative Kahn noted, the first change is moving to 3% for the Senate operating budget reduction, which is an increase of $918,000 from the previous House position. No changes for the Secretary of State, as both the House and Senate were identical on the recommended funding for that office. For the State Auditor, the offer is the House level of funding for the stimulus funds reporting and oversight, and does not include the operating budget reduction. For the Attorney General, the change here from the previous House offer is a reduction of $200,000 to the partial funding for House File 8 and 7. For the Governor's Office, at this point, there's no change in the recommendation from the previous House offer, which is the fully funding of the policy staff through the office, the Governor's Office budget, and the 5% operating reduction.
And I'd like to say we have the Governor's Office objected to the structure that we had here of just putting those directly into the Governor's Office. We do have language which we believe is acceptable to the Governor's Office that kind of sets up a separate account so that we have the transparency we want, but the Governor doesn't get the apparent dramatic increase to his budget on one line. I don't understand it all, but I think we do have something that's acceptable.
Yeah.
Sure. Do you want us to pass that out now?
Perhaps. I've seen some language, too, and maybe we should talk about
okay.
it in a few minutes, but I've got some concerns. Let's finish what we're doing here. Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to say that that language
yeah.
exists.
Okay, well, I'll make a note of it.
Okay.
Okay, continuing with the Department of Administration, there haven't been any changes in the health position. Again, we don't have the comparison showing to the last Senate offer, but I believe we would be the same on the in lieu of rent increase. A different, I think your last offer had additional funding of $1.6 million for the real property system, and this includes $1.48. The Office of Grants Management, we're still including the $250,000 direct appropriation, but the also including the offset in the revenue item. We did not pick up the reduction to the self-advocacy network grant. Still including the $25,000 one-time funding, and then the $1.2 million operating budget reduction, which reflects the fact that the EQB is not being transferred to the PCA. The differences for Department of Finance on line 44, the House has reduced its position on the federal stimulus match contingency from $1.775 million to $750,000, and has increased the position on financial oversight and assistance to $1.4 million. This is the governor's original recommendation and includes additional funding and positions for the bonding oversight function within that department. Moving on to the next page. There are two changes within the Office of Enterprise Technology, $250,000 in one-time general fund money for the data center pre-design. The previous House position had that coming out of a special revenue fund. And for IT security, the agency chargeback, this was a Senate position. The House has included $209,000 reduction, which is not the same as the Senate position, but again, for the campaign finance board, there's no change here, and I think as we've previously discussed, at least as far as the operating budget changes, we're similar on that, and that may be something that we would just want to talk about the different approaches to it, and similar for the Office of Administrative Hearings. On line 63, the change you'll see in the Department of Revenue Additional Tax Compliance Initiative is that actually the reduction in the appropriation to reflect the amount that was carried in the tax bill. No changes to the CAP board or the Indian Affairs Council from the previous offer or for any of the other small councils or amateur sports commission. Moving down to the bottom of the spreadsheet, you'll see here reflected the changes on lines 87 and 88 in the statutory appropriations for the MAPS replacement in the integrated tax system based on the additional information we had from the Department of Finance this morning. Moving on to the final page, again, at the top of the page, you'll see we still have in the agency reductions to offset the increase to the governor's office. And then the changes within the revenue items at the bottom of the page on line 110, there's the loss or the change in the additional tax compliance revenues, again, reflecting the amount carried in the tax bill. We've taken out the different items dealing with the state land sale since that was dealt with in the environment this bill, and then an increase from the previous position and a one-time transfer from the facilities repair and replacement account of $500,000, but leaving it in place the account itself. And those are the changes from the previous House offer.
Okay.
Chairman, can we ask some questions?
Sure. There are.
Let's see, where was it? You mentioned the compliance dollars reflecting that tax bill we sent to the governor. Now that it's vetoed, what is the impact here? Or we're just assuming that those dollars are gone, period?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't think it hurts us to assume that they're gone. You know, we'll have to do a budget if for some reason we get them back. I think we could easily distribute $14 million and
throw
out this bill.
I know we can, but the...
We'll find a way.
I'm reluctant to have just the assumption that the dollars are gone because they were put in a bill that has
no effect at this point.
You know, it's kind of a magic number.
I understand how that number is derived. But I just think we should be aware, is what I'm saying.
I think we all are.
That those dollars may or may not become law. So.
Well, I assume...
And if they're to be spent, because the veto is sustained, then it seems to me that this committee wants to have its oar in the water about where those dollars go and not just give them up to the tax conference without any objection. That's the only point.
I find nothing to disagree with that. But I guess I'm more Mr. Tim, but I guess I'm more optimistic that something's going to come together on the tax level that will still use those dollars as they were intended to be.
Just a caution.
Representative Philbrook, did you ask? Okay. All right. You know, we had heard...
Mr. Chairman, there's another...
Oh, I'm sorry. Sir Russ, yes, something else. Okay.
Representative Kahn, if the governor's office was cut only 3%, how much money is that? Does your staff know?
Well,
what that would mean there?
You know, we've taken two different approaches, and they're very little they're very little numbers apart. We cut the governor's office 5% on the lower number, and you cut the governor's office 3% on the higher number. And Ms. Roberts, can you
tell what's the discrepancy between the two positions? I'm just interested in that. I mean, it just looks. We talked about 3% for us, but then 5% for the executive branch governor's office makes me a little uncomfortable. Unless I understand how that.
You did 3% of a bigger number, and we did 5%, and we're getting. We'll tell you exactly what those differences are.
And there's another issue that it's coming up that we'll discuss as part of it. It came to my attention that the groundskeeper, was one of those positions, really probably belongs under the Department of Administration, not the governor's office. And so maybe we, you know, as we're talking about where the money lands, perhaps we should direct that funding over to administration so it is not carried as part of the governor's office, because there's probably no need for that. And admin really has that responsibility. So just trying to figure out, you know, how we're going to account for those positions. But Mr. Lundeen or Ms. Roberts, do you have any? We're talking about the cut to the governor's office, 3 or 5%, or you know, Mr. Lundeen?
Are we getting?
Mr. Lundeen.
Yes, Mr. Chair. If you just took a 3% just to the base direct general fund of the $7.4 million, that would be a total of about $222,000 for the biennium, so about $111,000 a year. And then what we had done in the Senate proposal was we had added the general fund base together with the interagency agreement dollars, which came up to be about $8.8 million. And that was a 3% cut there would have been $266,000 for the biennium.
So the net, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lundeen, the net difference between what the House just proposed and what the Senate has proposed before is what?
I believe it's $104,000.
Which way? We cut $104,000 more, or you do?
Less. The Senate would be less.
Yeah. The Senate's 5%. Is a $100,000 less of a cut than the House's 3%.
We proposed, the Senate proposed a 3% cut to the governor's office. As long as the Senate, we're suggesting the Senate, the House, and the LCC, we're going to have a 3% cut. We didn't feel comfortable then saying, by the way, Governor, your office is also going to have a 5%.
No, I understand that. That's why I'm trying to understand. When they were saying that their 3% is on a different... Their 5% is on a different base than ours. I want to know, I don't care what base it's on, what's the difference between the two?
Well, the base makes
a difference.
I understand, yes. But what's the number?
Yes, 104,000. And which way?
Madam Chair, the House cuts $104,000 more.
Okay, that's the answer.
Thank you. So the House needs to, but the other thing that the House can do, which we didn't do, is take the 3%, apply the 3% to that other chunk of the base.
I'm just trying to get away from apples to oranges and get to the actual money. Yes.
Well, one question I have is for the Attorney General's office. I know that you're trying to combine both House File 7 and House File 8, but I don't know whether the numbers you have split out the difference. As I say, we do have, I mean, the internal controls is something that, you know, we certainly want to be able to work on, that Senator Russ's issue. As I say, we have a bit of a problem trying to resolve the issue that I know it's a strong House position. On the false claims part, but that's an issue that's going to be heard of the finance committee on Monday. And you know, I'm still, as recently as last night, I was talking to Sarah Last, trying to figure out what we're going to be doing on that part. So, is there a way we can figure out from the House position how much of the money that you're dedicating here is for House File 7 and how much for House File 8? Is there a way we could split that out so I know what those numbers are? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just talked to Senator Last within the last half hour or so. I can't speak directly to the split between 7 and 8, and actually I think Representative Kahn and others put that in there as kind of a commingled amount. I will say that the House position all along, this is really a concession to the Senate in the sense that the House position all along is that there is zero fiscal note for a variety of reasons.
Well,
we put this in there. And, you know, we can have that debate offline. But we put this in there as an accommodation so that were the policy to be accepted, that the Senate would feel comfortable having at least some money in there. But our position is that there is no fiscal cost. For a variety of reasons, we don't need to rehash here.
Right.
But to your actual specific question, no, I don't know how that would break out.
Okay.
I mean, to us, any of it would be arbitrary. It's just throwing them some money that they claim they need. I don't know that even they have ever been real scientific about what they need. And I wish Representative Winkler was here to talk about House File 7.
Sure.
But he's not.
Well, and I don't know if anybody here from the Attorney General's office, before the Senate reviews this, they can talk about it. I see. Could you come forward and... please identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm Rebecca Sparks from the Director of Administration for the Attorney General's Office. And in terms of House File 7 and 8, I think most of our discussion has actually been about House File 8. Internally within the office, we do feel that the fiscal note that we presented was a fair accounting of what we felt would be needed. We did talk with Attorney General offices. In states where a False Claims Act had been passed, and that is what determined our fiscal note. We based it on the information they provided us about the number of staff that they either started with or added because of the False Claims Act.
Okay.
Representative Simon. Well, Mr. Chair, I wanted to avoid a rehashing of it, but I will rehash it then.
Well, it's part of the House offer here,
right.
So
no,
I have to discuss
I want to understand. And Ms. Bartz, you know, she's in a difficult position. I know she's got orders to say certain things, and that's fine. But, look, the bottom line is we've seen the list of who they claim they've talked to, and almost every state they talked to was a shall state, not a may state. And for those who haven't been following this, which is almost everybody, some states' False Claims Act say that the Attorney General shall get involved in these cases. Ours, like about half the states, say may. And I'll say what I've said before. We have looked and have not been able to find a single may state, not one, that had a fiscal note. Not a single one. And it is also telling, I should say, that though this started as an AG's initiative under Attorney General Hatch in 2004 and was an Attorney General's initiative in 2005, 2006, 2007 and 2008, there has never been a fiscal note. And suddenly, even though it passed the Senate floor a few years ago, and I think Senator Kubley that year was the author of that, magically this year, there is a $2 million per year fiscal note. Now, I'll let others draw their own conclusions as to why that magically appeared this year and not in the other years, even though no other May state has had a fiscal note of any kind that we could find. And when you compound that with the fact that this bill does not have a retroactivity provision, so it only goes into effect on or after August 1st. And I can tell you, as sure as I'm sitting here, I would bet my next paycheck there is virtually no way there's going to be any lawsuits under a State False Claims Act anytime within the first year. Why would anyone do that if it only applies to conduct arising on and after August 1st? You're not going to get a lawsuit on August 2nd, probably not September 2nd or December 2nd or April 2nd of the next year. Despite all that, and despite the history of no fiscal note, now this year, out of thin air, there's a $2 million per year, $4 million per year fiscal note. So I was hoping not to have to rehash that. I understand Ms. Bartz, who was there when I was at the office, you know, she's doing her duty here today. And so it's nothing against her, but I think the fiscal note is indefensible.
And that may very well be, Representative Simon. I'm a co-author of Senator Latz's bill. I mean, I like the policy. It passed through the Judiciary Committee that I serve on, and but policy and budget issues are two different things, as you well know. We do pass a number of very good policy ideas, but when the funding issue discussion happens, that's when the reality kicks in. We did hear Senator Latz did present the bill, and we spent about a half an hour actually in the budget division at crunch time trying to figure out what to do, and ultimately it was tabled because we couldn't figure out a way to reconcile the fiscal note with what Senator Latz was saying and what the other information we had. We just, you know, I mean, if I as the budget chair am given the authority to decide which fiscal notes to pay attention to, I can operate much differently than I do right now, but I haven't been given that authority. So Senator Cohen has made the decision to bring the bill up on Monday in the Senate Finance Committee. I have no idea what is going to happen then. I don't know how Senator Latz, I think, has given me an indication of the arguments he's going to make to the Finance Committee, but it puts me in a very awkward position trying to adopt something which might be very contrary to the position that the Finance Committee takes 2 days from now, and I don't know, that's going to be the key. I mean, I think I would guess if the bill got out of the Finance Committee and goes to the floor, I suspect it would be adopted. I don't know for sure, and it looks like any bill. But the key issue is what is the Finance Committee going to do on this one? Because I don't have that answer. It puts me in a very difficult position towards something in conference and booking something that I don't know how to do it. I mean, right now I have to go with the fiscal note and the information I've had, unless a greater collection of minds than the one I have in my head is able to resolve this. And so, I mean, just from that part, and that's why it's very important to me to be able to separate out the cost that you've booked for House File 7 and House File 8, because at this moment, you know, and now we can, if it's the will of the conference committee to keep the bill open over that issue, we may have to do that. But, you know, I'm not in a position today to resolve the false claims issue. But I would like to see what I can do on the internal controls part, if that's possible. So.
And for the time, Mr. Chair, if I could. And I understand that. And I understand in light of, you know, some pending procedural issues in the Senate that may be the case, that maybe we have to wait a couple days here. I understand it is getting a hearing in finance on Monday. Assuming it gets out of there, a hearing on the Senate floor as soon as Tuesday, and maybe then we'll just know a lot more about that. So I defer to the Senate process in that respect.
Mr. Chair.
Philippine.
Isn't this kind of similar to the compliance issue where we're spending money but there's revenue being raised on the false claims? Isn't there going to be, if this fiscal note is in fact true, won't there be money coming back to the state from that to offset that?
I don't know, Ms. Sparks. I mean, we've seen the fiscal note. We have in the budget division, it showed a $2 million a year cost. I don't know whether the possible revenues were factored in. I mean, Ms. Sparks, did you have any comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olstein, the individuals in office who prepared the fiscal note did attempt to look at what might be revenue I think it's difficult to predict what that might be. And then also in terms of the may and the shall, I'm not exactly certain, Representative Simon, if it's just a may to the Attorney General's office and the Attorney General's office really doesn't have to act, why the Attorney General's office is even called out in the bill. So I think based on that, we did not make an attempt to predict revenue.
Well, and that was actually a suggestion I made to Senator Last to look at that possible option, but
Tim, and the problem is, first of all, and I've heard Representative Simon say this so many times, I almost think I can do it accurately, but we do have some of the problems of this, of these issues that cross-cut divisions. Mm-hmm. So the state treasury is held harmless, but this division may not be held harmless. And I'll defer to Representative Simon to tell about what happens just as soon as we pass the act.
Representative Simon.
Well, there are two streams of money that I think we can count on, although I agree with Ms. Bartz that one of them is far more speculative than the other. The one that's most speculative, I would say, is the money we would get actually from cases arising under this False Claims Act. In other words, let's say we pass this, and let's say some whistleblowers come forward. We don't know if those suits are going to be successful or not. And I agree that that's the more intellectually honest approach is to say you really don't know. You can't say, particularly because we've gotten rid of retroactivity, I certainly don't think in the first couple years of this thing you're going to see any suits arise, many or any. I would venture to say probably any. So that is speculative. What is far less speculative and more solid, I would say, is this. The federal government said in 2006, and by the way, it was a Republican, Charles Grassley of Iowa, who's been a patron of this in Congress for many years, and Ronald Reagan, who signed the modernization of the Act 20 years ago. But Congress was so impressed with the ability of False Claims Act to raise money and to get money, particularly for programs administered jointly, like medical assistance or Medicaid, that Congress put in a bonus provision. And the bonus provision was to say, hey, states, if you pass a False Claims Act that has four criteria, and we have a written opinion from House Research, at least, that this bill meets those, if you do that, you're going to get a 20% bump or bonus on all your Medicaid fraud recoveries. And the way that works is this. Right now, since it's a 50-50 split in this state in terms of the funding, so too are recoveries. So the feds fund Medicaid 50% in this state, and so when we recover Medicaid fraud monies, we have to share it with them 50% as well. So let's say we had $10 million that came in the door in Medicaid fraud recoveries. Right now it's 50-50. We get to keep $5 million of it. $5 million goes to Washington, D.C. And what the feds are saying through this bonus provision is, if we pass this, just the reward for passing the law, if it never gets used, if it sits on the shelf forever and ever, and is never even invoked, we get a 20% ongoing, never-ending bonus on that piece of money. So that new $10 million comes in next year. Instead of keeping $5 million, we get to keep $6 million, and $4 million goes to the Fed. So if you look at the historical average, and I have that figure I could get for the committee, and again, it's somewhat speculative, but it's pretty reliable. If you look over, I think it's 7 or 8 years, and this is information from the Attorney General's office, that figure comes down to about $2 million a year, I think just shy, 1.9 something a year that we would get as the reward for passing it, even if no lawsuit ever arises under it. So that's a lengthy explanation, but of those two pots of money, I agree. One is speculative, one is far less speculative.
Well, I'm the only member of the Senate Conference Committee that is on the Senate Finance Committee, so I'll probably hear the very same argument Monday, but at least the other conferees that need to probably hear it will know more of that. Senator Jungbauer, you had a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simon, while I agree with you on some of these fiscal notes, I think to our peril, if we start ignoring them, we're going to have a lot of trouble. And I have the same issue. I had a bill that went all the way through the process, and right before it went to finance, all of a sudden comes up with a fiscal note. Now, we were able to deal with that, so if it comes out of finance, we'll be fine. But I wonder how some of these agencies, if they all of a sudden don't want to deal with things, I agree with you there. But the other end of it is we can't just pick and choose which ones we're going to accept or reject,
And so we've got to work through the process of paring those fiscal notes down with the agencies. Otherwise, we're all going to be in a lot of trouble here, I think, in the future. So,
well, Representative Simon, Mr. Chair, Senator, I agree with that. You can't just ignore it in the sense of picking and choosing, as you say. It has to be evidence-based. And in the House, what we did is we had folks come in at every stage of the process in three different committees, finance committees, and testify. And it was an evidence-based process. I agree that fiscal notes should be taken seriously, and the presumption should be, the initial presumption for everyone, regardless of any agency, should be that it's accurate. You should go in saying this is accurate, and if it changes, it should only be because evidence is presented, testimony is elicited, questions are asked, answers are hopefully given, and then, as members with election certificates, we get to decide whether we agree or not with their analysis. But these are human beings doing human things, and we're not robots or computers, and I don't think that because any agency or office provides a fiscal note that it is sacred. I think we are allowed to answer questions, and if we conclude, as we did in the House, that the fiscal note goes to zero for evidence-based reasons based on the testimony, I think that's okay, and that's what we've done in the House. The Senate can do what it wants, and I defer to the Senate to do what it wants, but I do believe that our approach to this in the House was an intellectually honest approach. So this wasn't wiping away fiscal notes that we just thought were inconvenient or getting in the way of something we wanted. We asked questions at all these. Now, reasonable people can come up with different conclusions. I'm not saying that it's intellectually dishonest if the Senate concludes, well, you know, there really is a cost there. I'm just saying that what we did was the product of questioning and testimony and reasoning by people.
Well, and I think every one of us has had a bill that had a fiscal note that was, I mean, it's sometimes speculative. I mean, the agencies make their best guess as to what they think the cost is going to be, and certainly in some instances, the Senate has taken position and said, well, we see the numbers here, but frankly, you know, we want this done, and we expect the agency to do it within their existing resources. But to just ignore it and just say, you know, we don't like it, and so we're going to go ahead notwithstanding, it's something that I can't remember too many instances of happening. I mean, we do look at the fiscal notes and try to make the, you know, best guess, good faith effort we can. Senator Dunbar, do you have something further?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I guess I'm still a little bit troubled in terms of the legislative body being able to kind of override it. In the cases I've had with agencies, we've sat down, gone through things, and then come up with language in which the agency felt comfortable that they were covered, and it took away that fiscal note. So hopefully we're going to work towards that end so that the agency is on board with us in the end. So I guess
just,
I'd like to see that.
For my benefit, Ms. Park, the Attorney General's office obviously has heard the House position, maybe seen any changes or suggested language, and I take it none of that has changed the Attorney General's office position on the fiscal note?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it has not.
It has not. Thank you. Representative Connors.
Well, what's very puzzling to me is once you make a must to a may, I think that that's a world of difference in what the agency has to do. And if an agency is still interpreting a may as a must, then I'm not sure why we ever do that.
Well, I don't know, and Ms. Sparks, as has been noted, is just relaying the position of the AG's office, so I guess I have to find out what the Senate Finance Committee's position is on that one, as I say, so I'm at a kind of a dead end as far as resolving that issue here today and on that part of the budget proposal. So, is there anything else on this issue, Representative Simon?
Thank you. I just want to close the loop if I can, Mr. Chair. On the month May, I mean, you know, there was some compelling testimony, I thought, in one of the divisions here where we happen to have Representative Kiffmeyer, who, of course, was former Secretary of State for 8 years, and we had a little fun, and she played along willingly. I said, Representative Kiffmeyer, did you know that in section, I can't remember what section it is, someone might know, of the statute, the Secretary of State's office has an ongoing authorization to hire a stenographer. God only knows when that was put into law. I said, there, for some reason, we thought it wise some time ago to put in there that they are permitted to hire a stenographer. I said, did you know that, Representative Kiffmeyer? She said, no, I didn't. I said, did you have a fiscal note every single year of your 8 years for a stenographer because you're allowed to? You may have a stenographer? She said, no, I don't think we ever did. Well, I think the point was made that if we funded, if we attached a cost to everything that an agency may do, we'd never get out of here. And so I'm not necessarily here to argue with Ms. Bartz and make a case that's going to be argued on Monday. What I am saying is that reasonable people can agree, and I think, or disagree, and I think fiscal notes are the product of real human beings. And I'll tell you what happened as to the MnDOT fiscal note in this, and this shows you how it's human beings, it's not a computer, it's not, it's human judgments, which can and should change. They came in with a fiscal note, I can't remember what it was, I think $16,000 per year. And it just came out during the House hearing that they just plain old misunderstood what the law did. And they changed it to a net $20,000. They just misunderstood, and that can happen. And it sounds like that's not the case in the AG's office, necessarily, but the point is, you know, we're human beings, and this sort of worshiping in the altar of a spreadsheet that comes out as if it's a sacred text or something, it just doesn't make much sense to me. So I don't think you're in quite the bind that you think you are, Mr. Chair. This is not a sacred text. It's the product of people and people's judgments, and judgments can be changed or can be wrong. So I don't think, just generally, and that's my statement in general about fiscal notes, just people coming up with guesses. And sometimes they're wrong because no one usually knows the bill as well as the author, and the agencies have to do this as to a lot of bills. And so it's no surprise that they might say, God, we never thought of that. So I don't think it's a bind when a fiscal note comes out. It's not passed down from the mountaintop. It's human beings making guesses and judgments.
Well, and my point again is it's not my call or this or the Senate conferee's call on this issue at this point to do. You know, I mean, a greater discussion in another forum has to take place. So, okay, Representative Solberg.
And I'm not going to belabor this, but I agree with you on trying our best to do the fiscal notes. They are advisory, yeah, always. But I would also point out that the House, in their budget proposal, has tried to accommodate, I think, the Attorney General's office in that as well by putting in 592. And that goes back to your first question, is there a separability of those? And I think that's difficult.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Sparks, anything further?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, that point has been made, and we do have statutory reference to fiscal notes, and they are specifically advisory to the legislature.
Sure.
There's nothing that ever makes them as non-advisory.
Well, as I say, given the fact that the bill is actually scheduled for a hearing in the Senate Finance Committee on Monday, that puts me in an awkward position here. We've seen the Senate proposal and the House proposal. There's a lot of common elements in there. There's some differences. I guess this would be a point in time if any of the major agencies or anybody really wants to call anything to our attention that we should consider, because as you can see, things might be, if you want, somebody wants to come forward and tells us something, you know, now is the time to do it. So any of the agencies or somebody want to talk to us about anything that we have in either bill, because I don't want to get to a point where we close up the budget and have somebody say that, well, we have some problems here. So now is the time to come forward. Welcome to the conference committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Christopher Boozy. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the state of Minnesota. I'd like to start off by saying thank you for moving towards establishing back on the Senate side some of the base for the Enterprise Security Program. It helps us continue some very important work that we began 2 years ago, thanks to the funding that was provided by this very body. But we are very concerned, nonetheless, about some of the budget cuts that are being made to the general fund base. And the move to the model that is a chargeback model, it becomes a difficult situation for us to carve up the program as it is today and try and figure out, you know, how do we provide some of these services and charge them to some of the agencies, and then how do we generally fund a portion of it. In addition, a lot of the issues that have been pointed out in the last couple audit reports on continuity of operations, assisting the small agencies. At the governor's proposed base, we already felt that it was going to be a significant challenge for us to accomplish a lot of those duties, to get our government in a position where it can respond to crisis better, to provide the assistance that small agencies need. So this is an additional challenge that we're also facing to get to that point as well. And then finally, one of the things that I think is very important to recognize is that security services today don't necessarily lend themselves to a fee-for-service model. The Enterprise Security Office actually becomes an important spoke in more of a national security system. We are the conduit with the federal government, the United States Computer Emergency Response Team, and we also provide those speeds and service, badly needed services for the local units of government as well. So, for example, last month alone, we managed about 60 cybersecurity incidents, of which about 70% of those incidents were things that impacted counties, cities, school districts, and local units of government. The model itself of trying to assess fees to the state-level government when a lot of the services blend across all different lines of government becomes quite problematic.
Mr. Chair?
Bill Seen.
It's interesting, in my day job, or my real-world job, I do a number of different things, and if I'm driving truck and they bill me for that, my time gets billed out under the truck department. But if I'm working in the shop, that time gets billed out differently, or if I'm doing sales calls, it's billed differently. I don't see this as, if we're going to have a kind of a business model, which kind of makes sense to me for what you, the services you provide, that it makes sense to me that, that all that stuff would be billed out to the people that are benefiting from the service. And you just countered that point, I know, but to me that is a model that would make sense, and I think it should be pursued more, actually.
Right. Ms. Chair, committee members, the reality is that when you looked at the way the state of Minnesota was before this body created the Enterprise Security Program, you know, 2 years ago, the reality was is that most of the things that needed to be done across government were not done because the agency simply did not have the money or the collective power to put the people together to make them happen. So I believe that we've went a long way over the last 2 years to help improve our situation. We have some stats and facts on some literature that we handed out showing that, you know, from a vulnerability management standpoint, where we did virtually nothing 2 years ago, by putting our heads together, we've been able to assess and correct 28,000 critical vulnerabilities in state government computer systems since we've been putting the enterprise vulnerability system together. And in addition to that, when you look at it from how does that impact people outside the state agencies, we're also helping out counties, cities, school districts, because we put this infrastructure in at the state level. Every month, we spend two entire weekends where we do external assessments on all the government entities that the Office of Enterprise Technology, we actually manage the address space. So we're doing vulnerability assessments of about 800 counties, cities, school districts, and other local units of government as well. Those type of services would be very difficult to run and manage without getting into a very complex, you know, fee-for-service operation, of which most of those organizations didn't do this in the first place because they simply don't have the money to pay for it.
Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up on that is, you kind of make my point for me. 800 school districts, counties, and local units of government, you know, the state is funding a great portion of this, but spreading out, maybe your shortfall over these people that you provide a service to, it would probably be a pretty small bill for them on their part to get 28,000 critical vulnerabilities fought off. So, I mean, I'm not saying that I think your program has been very helpful, but I think that maybe local government should be helping pay for it a little bit, too.
Welcome to conference committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Lally. I'm Planning Director for the Office of Enterprise Technology. It's important to bear in mind that in this day and age, we are so interconnected that finding easy ways to delineate who's in and who's out are much more difficult than they were even a decade ago. many of the people that depend on the services we provide get those services indirectly. They are not our customers as entities. They are customers of somebody else who is dependent upon us. But every time they have a compromised connection, whether or not we know about it or whether or not their provider knows about it, it's an opportunity for things to happen within the network that ultimately could affect all of us. And the reason that much of the funding has always been general fund is much like the reason why police officers are generally general funded. It's a little awkward to go to somebody who's been burglarized and ask them for their credit card before you start to do an investigation of the crime. They've been victimized once. To have government come in and charge them to do the inspection is adding insult to injury. We don't want to be in a situation where we have our agencies or the other customers that use our networks and our hosting platforms to have to deal with the kind of issues that you may have read about in the Washington Post about the state of Virginia, where some bad guys hijacked a medical society computer, copied off all the confidential health data and all of the prescription data, and then destroyed what was left and was holding it for ransom with that organization. They had encrypted it so nobody else could use it, and they were going to essentially demand ransom before they would return that information to its rightful place. I'm not sure what the resolution of it has been. I think they found a second generation backup data that they could bring in and lock down the system, but by then all that private information has already been released, and this was a secure facility. So the nature of the threat to the operations of a system, to the private data that's on the system, to the communications over the network, is not something that tolerates weak points. And the only way we can address those weak points is comprehensively from the top. You can't address them incrementally, place by place, going along trying to poke holes and insert glue into the dike to keep it from leaking anymore. These are leaks in critical information and processes, and it really has to be managed not on an as-you-can-pay basis, but on a comprehensive basis up front. And that's why the decisions to make the strategic security the responsibility of OET was made a few years ago. This takes us a step back, because we can bill the people that we have accounts with for security. And you may say that it's okay to accept the inequity of that billing because we'll go after the agencies we have a lot of services or a lot of people with, and they'll just fund the work that we do with these other jurisdictions. But that doesn't get to the accountability of any of the system, and it doesn't add to the fundamental equity of how state government is funded.
Mr. Chair?
Bill Thien.
In a perfect world, we'd write a check out for the MAP system. You know, we're in a budget crisis. Mr. Lawley, your point was well taken about, you know, it's just like prisons, you know, like we provide prisons for the bad guys. But in one of my counties, there's 10 cities, and I think 4 or 5 of them contract with the sheriff's department for their police protection. I don't see this as being much different than that. And my point I'm trying to make is that for probably a relatively small amount of money for each entity, the total of that may be able to address some of your budget shortfalls.
Okay, anything further? I mean, it's from the Senate's position, I mean, if we were to change that, we'd have to come up with another $4 million somewhere to do it. So.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I will point out that the House position pretty well balances with a little, much smaller niche there.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that, you know, we would like to reflect maybe part of the Senate's position by asking them to move towards a plan to look at what part of this could be done by charge back to the agency. This is obviously a huge, you know, all we have to do is think about how nice it would have been if Health Nuts hadn't happened, Health Nuts fiasco hadn't happened, even though that's not our money, it's federal money, but it's still our money.
Sure.
So there's huge savings here, and huge avoidance of losses here if it works. So I think what we, you know, we're obviously not going to final positions yet,
no.
But we'd like to go to the House financial position with
right.
Some of the Senate ones.
Well, and I want to flesh out where any problems are before we
we break here. Anything further from OET? Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Is there anybody else here who wants to call anything to the conference committee? Coming forward. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Jim Rhodes, Department of Administration. First of all, thanks for working on our stuff so well, but I just want to remind you about the EQB issue. The EQB is and through legislation will not be transferred. You're not moving it, and looks like nobody's going to be moving it. But the funding for the EQB has already been taken out of our budget, and therefore it would have to be replaced in so we can keep them working.
Okay. Okay. Good point. Okay. Well,
Mr. Chairman, again, I'll point that the House position does keep the funding for the ECB intact. So we've balanced it with keeping the ECB funding in place.
Okay. We'll take a look at that. Come forward here. Well, welcome to the conference committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier from the Office of the Secretary of State. And I just wanted to follow up on the OET discussion about the chargeback that as an office with a very large database, we have no idea what the chargebacks would mean. And so basically it's an additional cut to our office that we can't budget for because we don't know what the size would be. So Representative Kahn, you may have said something about doing a plan and then later implementing it. I mean, that at least would allow us and other agencies to know ahead of time what the charges would be. Right now the language says that they put together a plan and immediately implement it, which doesn't allow for budgeting.
Ms. Frazier, while you're here, there's a separate issue. The House bill has some HAVA money for the optical scanners. Now, we've also got a separate omnibus elections bill that's moving forward in that one, so I guess a decision has to be made, where we need to properly address that issue, whether it's this conference committee or a separate one dealing with that. But is there any thoughts that you may have on that?
Mr. Chair, members, it's an issue strictly related to extending an appropriation. So it seems like it may be more appropriate to have it in this bill.
I see. Okay. Thank you. Any questions for the Secretary of State's office? Okay. Is there anybody else who wants to address the conference committee on any issues that you've heard so far? Because as I say, you can see there's a lot of similarity, and we don't want to have again wrap it up and have somebody complain that they weren't heard or we weren't considered. I think the Senate's going to need a little bit of time, a few minutes to look over the House proposal and see how much we can finish today. What I hope to do with whatever time we have left is, Representative Kahn, do you think we might be able to resolve some of the common the Senate positions, the House positions, where we have similar language in here, and maybe get that wrapped up today. And if you want to discuss some standalone House positions, I think we're in a position to do that as well too. But I think while we're breaking, maybe if you want to take a few minutes and think about what you want to do there.
I think the most useful thing we could do today is one, have you break and look at the budget positions. We seem to be really pretty close on that, and that would be kind of nice to at least isolate where the differences are that we really have to work on that and see if we can do something. I would then like to work on the languages which are also which you now have a Senate position on, we can maybe, and that we're very close on, that there's no emotion involved in it, and maybe we can get some of those.
Figure out what the best language is, and maybe,
And there are at least two things where we have a couple of modified House positions, like an issue on technology issues. None of us managed to fund what was a high governor's priority, which was the data center consolidation, although I think we both kind of like it, if we could. That would be, if we get that $14 million tax compliance tracker, if he's going to address that, might be a really good place to...
Well, the house had some pre-designed money.
We have some pre-designed money, and I guess, guess we've changed that on the advice of finance. We had it coming from a an existing fund, and we've now done it from the general fund on the advice of finance. But that's a good thing we could look at if we. That's bad because it encourages the governor in his action. I don't know that we want to, but I think there may be some language things that we can put together and get off the table.
And while Ms. Roberts is going through the budget sheet, we did stop briefly to talk about the interagency funds and some different language. Maybe we could at least have that handed out now and kind of, because I had some similar language and I asked Mr. Bodden to look at it, so I don't know if we've got some language to talk about. The language that I saw from the governor's office did need some slight work, but it also went in a bit of a different direction, and I think maybe we should spend a few minutes and kind of talk about, you know, where we want to go on this. Yeah, this looks close to what I saw yesterday. This basically, it looks like it just gives a line item to the governor's office. It doesn't quite transfer the money over. Could somebody describe what we understand this to be? Again, this came from the governor's office, not from our staff. So, Mr. Shepard, do you have any thoughts on this, or describe what it is?
Mr. Chair, members, the language that just passed out does several things. First of all, it would put a cap. It would delete the House position, which is that any personnel costs attributable to the Office of the Governor have to be accounted for through an appropriation to the Office of the Governor. That would be deleted. It would delete the Senate language making a direct, the Senate rider that notes that $724,000 each year of the Senate appropriation includes personnel costs incurred by the Office of the Governor. So those both would be deleted, and in its place it says that it would authorize the Office of the Governor to receive up to $724,000 each year, the biennium, from other executive agencies to support the personnel costs incurred in the governor's office. Second, it would provide that these payments would be put in a special revenue account and then appropriates the money in that account to the Office of the Governor. And third, to try to clarify the relationship to bills that have already been enacted this year, it says that the authority in this paragraph to receive these payments of up to $724,000 would supersede other laws, such as the Environment Bill, that limit the ability of the governor to enter into agreements with other executive agencies.
Well, you know, I guess we can spend a few minutes and talk about it. And if there's anybody from the administration who wants to weigh in on this, you know, we'd certainly welcome that too. I sort of thought it'd be more transparent and cleaner if we just, as I said, give the money to the governor's office and said, you know, here's the money, you know, hire the people. This kind of goes in a, I think, actually the opposite direction from doing that, but, you know, we'll just have to see what the will of the conference committee is. And as I know, as a side issue, we may have to figure out where we want the groundskeeper to do, because I think that really does belong to the Department of Administration and not charged to the governor's office or whatever is happening now. But any thoughts, Representative Conner, members of the conference committee?
My thoughts is I think we completely agree with you on the, it was not seeing any objection from any of my members. We agree with you on the groundskeeper issue. And I agree with you in principle about the ease of just putting it into the governor's office, but I understand the governor's sensitivity about not wanting that in, that bump up. And this process, while a little possibly convoluted from my taste, gives us what we wanted, which was this transparency, and identifies those people as governor's policy people instead of kind of this intermingling that wasn't clear where they are. So I'm, you know, philosophically I agree that what you said is correct, but I'm perfectly willing to accept this, and somebody should work out the groundskeeper issue.
Okay, and as I said, I'm not quite sure the language actually, you know, it might need a little bit of work, but we can work with counsel on that if this is what the will of the conference committee to do is. Is there anything else that anyone wants to bring up before we take a brief recess so the Senate can spend a few minutes and look over the House counteroffer? And again, if anybody out here wants to bring anything to our attention, now would be a good time to do it. I don't see anybody moving forward, so why don't we break for about 25 minutes. We will not resume. It's now about 10:50, so I don't anticipate we will be back before 11:15. So we will certainly not start before 11:15. Everybody needs to, you know, go out and do something right now. So okay. And as I say, I hope to be done by late morning, early afternoon. So we're not going to stick around all day to do this stuff. So okay. Any questions? Okay. Well, then we're in recess until no earlier than 11:15. Okay. Okay, take two. We're back on the record for the State Government Conference Committee. It turns out that there were some old spreadsheets mixed in with the new ones. They're kind of sorting that out right now. So in a few minutes, they'll have all the spreadsheets available to us. But before we start, I want to make sure that everybody in the room gets one that has one. And so we're going to hand out a few right now at the desk here, but we won't start going through them. Perhaps we can spend just a few minutes talking about some of the policy issues, and once we get all the spreadsheets in here, we will then go right into that. So, Representative Kahn, did you have anything on the policy things that you wanted to clear off the decks here?
Yeah, I think we have the Senate File 2 Sandy Mason item.
Okay.
So I don't know if that'll be passed out.
Is that the long-range planning and demographer and so forth?
And I think Senator Clark has just gone over it, and I think if he's okay, we know that we're okay.
Okay. Okay, what's being handed out is called, it's designated MS-082, which was part of the House bill, and it's also what it was Senate file number 2. It deals with the Strategic Office long-range planning, state demographer, Minnesota milestones report. Is there anybody who's here who wants to be heard on this amendment? And as I said, it's just being handed out now, but it's my understanding that the people who had an interest in it have had a chance to look this over, and I believe that there seems to be agreement on the language here. Mr. Gillespie, did you want to be heard on this? Welcome to back to the conference committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Gillespie. I'm state demographer in the Minnesota Department of Administration, and I have had a chance to review the language of the amendment, and I have no concerns to the language.
Okay.
Chairman, you want a motion?
Yeah, well, is there anybody else who wants to be heard on the amendment here then? Well, actually, we can't adopt it because we're short on the House quorum. So I think what we're going to be able to, we're just going to have to make a list of the stuff, and I don't think we're going to have a House quorum for the rest of the day. So when we have another, we'll establish a House quorum, we'll figure out what's on both sides, and then we'll move everything.
I would move that this language be included in language that we adopt.
Is there any discussion by the conference committee on the MS-82 amendment? Okay, we will lay it over, and then, as I say, at the appropriate time when we have a quorum on both sides, we will vote on that. Okay? So, that is one item. What else do we have?
Wisconsin.
Well, the next one, I think, is auditor's test. Okay. Next item is going to be handed out a JM054. This is regarding the state auditor and the tax increment financing language. And after it's handed out, we'll have a brief discussion about what that does.
Mr. Chairman, is this language okay with the auditor? Is that she's not here now, too?
Okay.
So
she was here earlier,
know.
But a
oh.
Prefer, well. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know that we do, because again, we can't vote on it right now, but did somebody want to just describe basically what the language does so we fully understand what it is here? Mr. Shepard, did you want to tell us?
Mr. Chair and members, this was originally language that was in the Senate bill. It begins on page R83 of the side-by-side,
mm-hmm.
and the auditor Otto had suggested, in working with some of the tax staff, these changes, and they were all agreed to. She saw this earlier this morning and said this language was fine with her. So she would like this language to replace section 31 in the Senate bill, and then she would also like this if the conferees would adopt Section 32 on the Senate side, beginning on page R85 and continuing through R88 on the side-by-side.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Russ.
Chairman, was this language part of a bill?
Yes.
Representative Lemchesky's bill? Is that correct?
Senator Cohen's bill, Senate File 2.
The tax increment stuff?
No, it was a budget. The reform bill that he had put together, it was Senate File 2. This was a number of provisions that were part of Senate File number 2.
Okay.
Not the TIF language. I'm sorry, not the TIF language.
No, so that's what I'm talking about, the TIF language.
I'm
was the TIF language part of this?
Where was
bill? We've been looking at, in the Tax Conference Committee, at some technical changes in tax increment, streamlining things. Is this similar, or is it the same, or
Mr. Shepard, somebody? Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, this language, the JM on the top is Joel Michael. This is the language that he gave to the Tax Conference Committee that had, he said, had been agreed there.
Yes.
This is identical language. This concept was contained in your Senate bill that is now before the Conference Committee, but I don't know the origin of it before that in the Senate.
And so this language then, if we adopt it, would eventually be in this bill rather than the tax bill. That's what I'm trying to... I mean, it could be both places, but there's no need to kill an additional tree to do that.
So when the motion is made, we're throughout the JM054 amendment, and then which sections of the bill, the conference committee report do we have to also adopt to go with it, Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair and members, the JM054 language would replace Section 31 of the Senate bill on R83, but also going along with it, it would be requested that you adopt Section 32 of the Senate bill on beginning on page R85.
Okay.
And that is my understanding. That would match up with what was agreed to in the tax, the tax conference committees as well.
Got it. Okay.
Just a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. And just looking at the side-by-side on page 85 to 88, R85 to R88, where is the House language in there? Is it elsewhere on the side-by-side, or did this come in through another?
The House Mr. Chairman, the House had no language on the tax increment finance, but this went along with the order to give it, saying that there was $1 million in her fund that she could give up into the pool. And my intention, and obviously we really need a total sign-off from the auditor, although since it was in the tax bill, I can assume that happened. And my intention is to get a stack of these amendments that the Senate agrees to and that we believe that there's no objection to on the House side, but since we don't have a quorum, we're not fully... So we will have the time to do it, but we're hoping that the motion to... except all of these will be easily done the next time we convene with quorum on both sides.
Okay.
Okay.
Other issues that we can address right now? Mr. Shepard, is that something else, sir?
Check with Mr. Bodern, but I think we identified this morning the Senate passed out a version of Senate File 1481 that passed the Senate, and there are two sections there that are identical to provisions in the House side by side, or nearly identical. We have one, I think Mr. Bodern and I would have a small technical change to suggest on the side by side to make them identical. The first one it would be on the side by side, it's on page R45.
Okay.
In Senate File 1481, it was Section 7, and it relates to a report on the budget reserve percentage. And Mr. Bodern can help me out here, but I believe on the Senate, in order to make the House language identical to what passed the Senate, on R45, line 36.21, after the word chairs, you would insert "and ranking minority members." That was a Senate floor amendment.
Okay, the House would have no objection to that.
And Mr. Chair, the second part of Senate File 1481. It was Section 8 of Senate File 1481, and it's on page R91 of the side-by-side. And it is on the House side, Section 80 there. In order to make that consistent with the way that the bill passed the Senate, on line 61.27 and on line 61.28, after the word chair, insert "and ranking minority member."
Okay, again, the House would have no objection to that.
What was the second line, Mr. Shepherd? Our 61.27 and what was the other
and one? And 61.28, Mr. Chair.
28, thank you. That, there it is, yes, thank you. Okay. Got it. Okay. Other issues for language that we can pick up here?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if the conference wanted to take this up. It's not an issue that I'm totally familiar with, but someone was mentioning a provision relating to Wisconsin employees working in Minnesota, and I don't know if that's an issue that you would like to address.
Apparently we don't have any language drafted right now, so since we can't, we do. Okay, well, maybe we should hand it out and see what we've got here. So,
Mr. Rhodes looks like he's
okay. And I didn't ask if anybody was here to talk about the last item on the budget reserve issue, but again, since it was identical language in the House and Senate, there's probably not much that can be done there anyway. So, Mr. Rhodes, welcome back. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, members of the Jim Rhodes Department Administration. This was brought to us by Wisconsin. As you know, we're doing joint ventures with Wisconsin, and it deals with the concerns about liability with a Wisconsin employee working in Minnesota and a Minnesota employee working in Wisconsin. And basically, it protects them from because they're working in another state. This, by the way, I should say, Senator Mua saw it as well, and Peter was there at the time, and she said it was okay. This is going to set a national trend for others doing business in other states, but we're basically just protecting our workers that happen to be like the DNR or public safety.
Okay. Any questions? Mr. Rhodes.
Mr. Chair. I had a bill that passed that addressed for emergency workers. That if a Minnesota St. Croix or Taylor Falls police officer or fireman went to St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin to work on a fire, that they would be protected from liability and those kinds of things. So is this kind of the similar kind of a
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olstein, yes, but just keep in mind these are protections that are for tort purposes only. It has no impact on workers' compensation in either state.
Does the state of Wisconsin have anything similar that they're working on? Do you know, Mr. Rhodes?
Chairman, members, they are passing it the same this week as well, next week as well.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Rhodes? Anybody else wants to be heard on this issue? Okay.
Mr. Chair?
General Fee.
To that, it's 1.13 and 1.14,
mm-hmm.
where it doesn't include a city, town, or local government body. That's kind of interesting that it's not included, because what if, what if somebody from local government, if there was an emergency or something like that, and, they bring the snowplow truck over or something, and would...
This is a state liability issue, so Mr. Rhodes?
Mr. Chairman, you were looking on the first page?
Right. Yeah.
That's
court,
already
court law.
Law now. That's
okay.
Court law. This is all current law.
Just
add that one line.
The new language is on lines 2.2 to 2.3.
Right.
Again, I can't imagine any problem with the House on this, so we'll just put that in the pile.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other things that people want to bring to our attention right now? From your side, and we'll start with the budget sheet momentarily. Let me just go through my list. We've got there's a couple of issues. We don't have need to address them today, but I'll just put them on the radar screen. Madam Chair, you and I had talked. We talked about the. I think we have to figure out, resolve the issue, what we're going to do on the name change for the Department of Finance. We've got some language in the House bill. There's a vacation donation issue. Senator Tomasoni had it, and I think we need to figure out if what we're going to do. You and I have talked about veterans' preferences. The councils of color, which was moved out of the economic development bill and now is properly in this bill, figure out what we're going to do on EQB. You talked, Heritage Council, that's an issue that's really neither bill, but there's a council ready to expire. And then we had adopted an 820 amendment on the Office of Administrative Hearings, amended the language, but we have not adopted the language for the conference committee report. So there's a number of issues that are still hanging out there that we'll still have to address at the appropriate time. So we've got more issues to deal with on the House positions and so forth, but I just scribbled down some things that I know that we have to make sure we take care of before we clean things up, but that won't be today.
Okay.
So, is there anything else on the policy side that we should talk about before we look at the budget sheets? Okay, has the budget sheets been distributed to the public and everybody here? Everybody's got them? Everybody's got the sheets. Okay. We now have the Senate offer on the bottom right-hand corner should say printed 5-9-2009, 11:47 a.m.
Runs
this 12:06. I'm sorry? Oh, it's the same sheet. Okay. Well, it's printed at a different time. It's the same version. Okay. So, Mr. Lundeen, could you kind of walk us through here what the Senate's proposal is?
Okay. Starting at the top with the legislature, there is no difference from Senate Offer 1. The only difference with the House is the funding for the Fiscal Policy Commission for the oversight. Secretary of State...
Which line is that, so?
That would be line 7.
Line 7, okay, gotcha. Yeah, go ahead.
Secretary of State, that remains the same. Both the House and the Senate are the same on that. Taking a look at the state auditor, we have moved towards the House of not making the operating budget reduction. Then the dollars would be the same for the state auditor.
The Senate has recognized, and we've had discussions with the state auditor that although we do believe that we have to cut agencies and so forth. The state auditor is somewhat unique because they're the ones who, especially when the economy is bad, they get the busiest because they have to do more audits and there's more opportunities for theft and so forth. And we recognize that's an issue there. So they actually can help raise money if they do more audits, and cutting them is probably not a good thing to be doing at this particular time. So that's why we agreed with the House position on that. So, Mr. Lundeen.
Okay, then moving to the Attorney General, I think we did have discussion about the partial funding for House File 8 and House File 7 and waiting for the Senate Finance Committee to deal with that particular bill.
And as I said, we are not going to be able to resolve that issue today, so we're not able to do anything there.
Okay, then moving down to the Governor's Office, what we are proposing to do there is that earlier language we had passed out dealing with the special revenue fund for the interagency money. We would propose having the interagency money to go through that special revenue account, but we would take the $724,000 and make a 3% cut to that, and then the $111,000 there represents a 3% cut to the general fund base of the governor's office. So overall, the governor would have the same 3% cut that we're proposing for the legislature.
And we might need to massage the language based on what the governor's office submitted to us and trying to figure out where to put the groundskeeper. But I think this is the general concept here, to put the money in a special revenue fund and then have a 3% cut to the governor's office. Go ahead.
Okay, next, moving down to line 30, the Department of Administration. The changes there with the real property management on line 31. The Senate moves towards the House level of funding, and then also the House proposal or language that sets up the account. The next item, with the Office of Grants Management, we still have the difference there. The Senate is proposing just to straight out fund it with general fund and not take anything off the top of the grants. The Senate continues the self-advocacy grant reduction.
And the reason why is because in the Human Services Bill, they're actually trying to move that into the Human Services budget. So I think over the next day or two, we need to figure out just what is happening there. We might have to look at something where we fund it this year and let Human Services fund in the future. But since obviously we shouldn't be funding it in two different places, so we need to track what's really happening in Human Services, where those self-advocacy grants are going. So I think no action at the moment is probably the prudent thing to do, and then we'll certainly have to revisit this to figure out how we're going to be handling this. Wendy?
Okay, then moving down to line 38, the operating budget reductions. The Senate is going to the same number as the House for the reduction, and basically what that does is it gives full funding to the EQB. Moving down to line 41 for the Department of Finance, we basically are in agreement with the House's funding positions there. Moving down to line 48, Office of Enterprise Technology, on the data center consolidation, we're actually proposing to do the original House position, which was taking the appropriation to the Department of Administration out of the special revenue account in the Office of Enterprise Technology for the data center pre-design. And then moving down to line 49, the IT security, we actually are taking away the cut that we made in the 10 and 11 biennium and then asking the Office of Enterprise Technology to do the study for the next biennium, so we wouldn't include any dollars in the tails for this. We'd have them come back with a study on how they would do a charge back and how that would work so that we can relook at that issue for the next biennium.
And I think that we feel that once we start going down the road of the chargeback, and we're pretty much committed there, so I think we thought, well, we can still fund them at what they're doing for one more year, do the study, and if there's a way to, keep going without the chargeback, we might be, but we're obviously just pushing the major decision off, but trying to keep the funding going for the time being so we don't have to do the chargeback. Ms. Lindeen?
The next item, Campaign Finance Board, we're in agreement on that. Turning to page 2, administrative hearings, we're in agreement on. I think jumping down the other items, we're not, I guess basically on line 87 and 88 for the maps and the tax system, we just basically adopted the approach that the House had put in their last offer and what Ms. Andrews had testified to this morning. And then also on line 95 under the general reductions for the interagency agreements to fund the governor's office aren't showing up on here, but rather would be treated as a special revenue appropriation and coming in. So it would still be coming out of the agencies, but through the special revenue rather than to the general fund. And then going to the last page, the only other change there was on line 114, the fund transfer from the facilities repair and replacement account. We have that currently at almost 3.2 million, a one-time transfer. And that's the proposal.
I think if you back up to 109, the Office of Grants Management, that again reflects the direct appropriation and not skimming the money off.
Correct.
Okay. So that is where the Senate is at the moment.
Are there any questions, or are there any, this obviously moves us much closer together. There are, of course, things that we just could immediately, since we had a quorum, agree to accept, but I guess at this point, since we're not going to close it up, I prefer to wait until we do it. And I almost think, looking at some of the things that I'd like to do differently, I think we're awfully close together on money. We did have, I would like people from OEC to talk about if there's anyone who can talk about the kind of things that they're doing. You moved back, after we moved off the original House position on the data center consolidation, you moved back to it, and I don't know if there's anyone here who would like to talk about it and the kind of thing that they're doing with planning right now. So, okay, we're talking about the data center consolidation issue.
Again, welcome back, Mr. Lally. You'll have to identify yourself for the record again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Lally from the Office of Enterprise Technology. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions.
Well, the position that we're dealing in with right now is that the House has given $250,000 for that issue. We had originally done it from the special revolving fund. We then did it from the general fund, and we also talked with some of your people about adding a little bit more money, possibly from that revolving fund, so that we wouldn't increase it. Now, the Senate has gone to our original position from the revolving fund, and I guess the question is if you could just talk, not, we're not talking about House or Senate positions now, but if you could just talk about what you think about it, and why you don't want it from the revolving fund, I guess, and why you want a little more money than the 250.
Mr. Lally.
And if you sure. can't, we're coming. We're not doing any decisions today. So anything you want to say on it since you're in the room.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chairman, members, what we've talked about, the initial money that was put aside was to do an executive branch analysis, do pre-planning is what we call it, because it doesn't get us through the pre-design process. And if you look at the Capitol building, there are particular labels that apply to particular disciplines in that. This would let us finish the pre-planning, and when we got to that point with you, we would be working closely with the Department of Administration. So if we went into a pre-design, design-build scenario for next session and possible inclusion in the bonding bill, we'd be quite a ways ahead of that process and be able to accelerate it. The question that was asked of me a few moments ago was if that amount was greater, could we look at doing that pre-planning process with some of the potential partners in that data center that are not within the scope of this original study? And my answer was, and I think it's a correct answer, we could advance the contemplation of those partnerships to the point that if it was the desire of the governor and the legislature to move towards a multi-organizational data center next spring, we would have that level of preparation ready, and it would shorten the pre-design process and reduce the cost of that and allow us to move into a design build situation with partners that included, and among those you've heard the speculation would be Minsky, the University of Minnesota, and perhaps some local government units. And that's where we are right now is our best estimate of what we would accomplish with that.
Okay.
My guess is, of course we're not ready to do it at this point, my guess is that the House counteroffer, and there was language also on study that Representative Downey had, and so I think our counteroffer will probably include fleshing that out.
Sure.
So,
any other questions, Mr. Lally? Okay, is there anything else that we need to address today from anybody on the conference committee? Is there anybody who's here who wants to bring anything for our attention? We're getting ready to adjourn for the day, so if there's anybody who wants to tell us anything, now is an appropriate time to do that. I don't see anybody coming forward. So, Representative Kahn, what is your plan for the next meeting?
Well, my plan is House committee is a kind of meeting before session, and so my plan is to call the Monday. Not to meet Sunday. I don't see any progress that could be made that would worthy a Sunday meeting. My plan is Monday to do it after the last House adjourns, but I think the House also has Finance Committee, which most of us are on at that time, so it will be after the last House and after the House Finance Committee. And so all I can say is just, and obviously, if all of those get to be too late, and I don't know what too late is, kind of 9 or 10 or something like that at night, I'd like too late to be earlier than that, but then to cancel the meeting for the day. So I'm sorry we can't be more definitive, but that's the way it goes.
Okay, well, and to those to whom it applies, happy Mother's Day tomorrow. And then Monday is Statehood Day, so we've got a couple of significant days.
The chandelier will be lit.
The chandelier will be lit, so stop by the rotunda and look up and gawk at it for a while. So, anything further? So,
and it's our responsibility to notify our individual chambers at that.
Yeah,
church.
To go and gawk. Okay, well, thank you for coming in this morning, and the meeting is adjourned.